This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, hosted by me, Robbie, and by my good friend, Kyle. And today, we have a very special episode, and I know what you're thinking. You guys say that a lot. Well, to be fair, we have a lot of special episodes. But this episode... Okay, we told you guys already. This week has been a big music week. We've been hoping to have a week like this probably since we started this podcast. Kyle and I spend a ton of time listening to these film scores. We love them. We follow the composers. And so we've had a ton of fun seeing you guys engage online and seeing how much we're not alone there, which I love because I know a lot of folks don't really dig into that. I'm sure... composers kind of appreciate you doing so, but all of that, this whole past week has kind of culminated in our chance today to interview Henry Jackman, who composed the film scores for Captain America the Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, and most recently, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
And this interview, guys, does not disappoint. Like, hear me out. Everyone who's come on our show has been so amazing, and we have loved doing these interviews, and the guests we've had are incredible. This interview in particular, though, is going to blow your mind. It exceeded our expectations. So it's lengthy, but trust me, this is some of the most fun musical MCU content we've ever had. Like, this is our jam.
It is truly unlike anything else we've gotten to be a part of on this show. And it's also one where if you have the ability, if you have the chance, after you've listened to the podcast, and you'll know why once you've listened to it, you might enjoy going to look up the video that we'll be posting on YouTube as well. And I think on IGTV, at least in part.
Right. So, you can watch all of our interviews there, but this is one in particular that you might want to watch. But also, Robbie, before we dive into that really quickly, I have a few leftovers from our music episode on Monday, and a few announcements, okay?
Okay.
One, on the leftover front really quickly, we got a lot of feedback about why didn't you include Thanos' theme? And apparently, we had that discussion, you know? A lot of people thought that Thanos' theme is kind of those two notes at the beginning of Infinity War. And if that is the case, I agree. I probably would have chosen that. It is that memorable. Like, at the very beginning of Infinity War, when you hear the...
right.
Boom, boom, boom. You know exactly what it is. So, you know, that's maybe a mistake on my part is what I'm saying. I'm willing to admit I was wrong. I probably should have included that. Everyone on this podcast knows how much I love Thanos, so don't need to get jumped on there.
Well, we also got a lot of feedback about Porch, though, which I do think you were right to say is not, well, maybe it's most memorably used for Thanos at the end of Infinity War, it does show up in other places that are not in a Thanos context.
For sure.
So I stand by that one.
If you missed that episode, first of all, go listen to it. It came out on Monday. It's our power rankings of themes in the MCU. But also on Instagram, I went berserk on our stories, posting maybe like 40 stories of clips of our favorite music in the MCU in general. So If in general this music week has piqued your interest, we have outlets for you. You can go to Spotify and follow a playlist we made called Journey Through the MCU. And even if you don't have Spotify Premium, you can still go there and shuffle the songs. And you'll hear a lot of Henry Jackman songs on that as well. So it's kind of a perfect tie-in. But we don't get anything from that. That's literally for you guys because we listen to it ourselves for entertainment. So it's just a really fun place if you want like a few clips of songs from all the movies and film, like while you're driving, while you're working, whatever. It's really fun. So Journey Through the MCU playlist on Spotify.
I've also got to say, Kyle, we did put up a poll.
Yeah, I got crushed.
After we made our teams. You know, and look, it's got to be said. The polls are not fully closed, but CNN is projecting a Team Robbie victory at this point.
It was like 72-28 or something at this point, so I feel like it's a fair, you know, I probably blew it not taking Thanos' theme. I get it. I do think some people are underrating like the Ant-Man theme, guys. Like, okay, go back and listen to it. I'm not crazy. Go listen to Anthropody.
If you hadn't taken it, I would have.
Right, exactly. So, but your team was good. Your team was good. Doctor Strange is a solid pick, you know?
I think the Cap theme is what put me over the top, I have to believe, based on some folks' comments. But, you know, the Doctor Strange theme, like we said, Monday, is one that is way underrated. And so that's why I hope, if nothing else, from this week of us just bombarding you about music, that we've exposed you to a few tracks, a few things that are maybe not the ones that immediately come to mind when you think of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that are really worth sitting with, and some scores in general that are worth chasing down.
But also, I need to quickly add, this has nothing to do with music, but on Monday's episode, we also announced a couple massive things. Right now, for a limited time, you can still get your first ever Friends From Work t-shirt. They're super comfortable, they're super cool, so seriously, go to the ffwpodcast.com/shop, and you can find it there. We also included a donate button on there if you want to help support our podcast. The shirt money helps support us as well, and we're very proud of the shirts. So it's a pretty fun thing. And just as kind of a PSA, starting in 2 weeks, our main episodes are going to be coming out on Thursdays for a little bit of time because Loki will be coming out on Wednesdays, okay? So just as a heads up, start adjusting your schedules. We got a couple more Monday episodes, then we're going over to Thursdays for a little while. Don't panic. Same great content you love, just now on Thursday. But I need to stop talking because this interview is so much fun. Okay? So without further ado, guys, here is award-winning composer Henry Jackman on Friends From Work. All right, everyone. Our very special guest today, our highly anticipated, long-awaited guest, is the award-winning composer Henry Jackman. Let's go. Welcome to Friends From Work,
yes.
Henry.
Well, what an introduction. Thanks for having me. I'm very glad you invited me.
Well, thanks for being here. Are you kidding me? This is honestly our pleasure.
As our listeners know, this has been one that we've been hoping to do for a long time. People have heard us sort of rant and rave about all sorts of tracks that you've composed. But one of the first things that Kyle and I always like to do before we get too swept away in our fandom there is just asking, what is your personal history with Marvel? Is that something that you sort of grew up with, or is that something that you found just through the MCU?
That's a really good question. It ties into something I was talking about the other day, because you would imagine that the perfect candidate to be doing like Captain America, well, at least would for a start be, you know, American. Now, I know, you know, the relationships in the UK and USA is, you know, maybe closer than, I don't know, like Indonesia and Canada or something. You know, they're quite related countries. But the truth is, when I grew up in England, I won't bore all your listeners with the sort of, you know, full history of my childhood, but you know, I had a very I went to a sort of a monasterial 1950s British ecclesiastical boarding school where I wasn't reading, you know, I was singing 16th century European church music and, you know, showing up to Lady Diana's wedding in St. Paul's Cathedral and that kind of thing, and was not like skateboarding and reading Marvel comics. If anything, I was reading these sort of what would be culturally very different British comics, like the Beano and the, you know, completely different kind of comics. But having said, so you would think that, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, a great background to enter the Marvel Universe. But, you know, the funny thing is, because I think it was in relation to talking about doing the Comey show, you know, it was the whole political thing about Trump and Comey and whatnot. Sometimes it's good to have a fractional outsider in a way to, like, I love, so for example, I'm skipping out a bit. Yeah. So for example, when I first talked to Joe and Anthony Russo about Winter Soldier, fact that I hadn't had this loose background subconsciously of like, oh yeah, you know, I remember reading all these comics, meant that I actually sort of did quite a lot of homework, because it wasn't just background childhood knowledge. I, you know, signed up on my iPad and munched my way through endless Captain America comics. It was because I did that when I was much older. It was actually sort of intellectually interesting, because if you read the really early Captain, I mean, the seriously early Captain America, it's borderline US government propaganda.
Right.
Because, right. You know, you get these, in some of those early ones, you'll get.
We do that well here, okay?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, no, who doesn't? You know, you get scenes where, you know, like Captain America talking to some 7-year-old kid and go, hey, kid, let me tell you how to spot a communist. You know, it's like, and because it came from the era of great political self-confidence that America had coming out of the Second World War, where, you know, compared to the disaster of Europe and the Nazis and all the rest of it, it was a period of sort of justified American exceptionalism, where people felt confident about the being patriotic, and no one thought it was cheesy. Right. There was nothing ironic about saying Captain America, a sentinel of liberty. But then if you read the Captain America in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot has happened in America. The Vietnam War's happened. And it's really interesting, because the Captain America graphic novels reflect the public mood of America. So that, you know, by the time you've got like race riots, and, you know, then you get stories of Captain America kind of drunk somewhere in Southeast Asia, you know, not confident about the government he's supposed to represent, and uncertain about, you know, the political motivations of, you know, this, that, and the other, which you would never have got in the early version. So, you know, all of that, I don't, you know, you wouldn't be having those kind of thoughts if you were just reading comics when you were like 9 years old. So it was. So that's what I mean about having a slight outsider perspective. I mean, I've always loved, to be honest with you, I've always loved, I don't, you know, given that I'm a pretty pretentious individual who likes to waffle on intellectually about things, what I don't suffer from, you know, you get those people that, oh, you know, I only watch sort of black and white Swedish art movies. I have never suffered from the disease of thinking that because something is popular, or
it's
has or has a superhero thematic subject, that therefore it's somehow trashy. I absolutely reject that, and think that I was massively influenced by Richard Donner's late 70s, or when I can't remember when that Richard Donner first Superman.
The Superman film?
Yeah, that I think it's a great movie, and I think it has really iconic and mythic subtexts. The whole Moses beat of some entity having to leave a dying planet to go somewhere else, you know, as the planet is all failing, he's put in the equivalent of a cosmic basket sent across the Earth, across the universe, with, you know, Marlon Brando as this. It was Shakespearean. There are shots that make me weep in that movie, to do with a kind of mythic representation of rural America and the values of ordinary, you know, how he's brought up by his parents, you know, his like the parents who discovered him, you know. So meaning it's really resonant with, and don't forget, Kevin Feige worked for Richard Donner when he was really young.
That's right.
So I didn't know that.
It sounds like I'm being really rude. Like, why the hell is he talking about Superman when we're here to talk about Marvel? But actually,
no.
I think some of the secrets to Kevin's genius, because Chris Nolan went in a very different direction that was very psychologically realistic. Notice how he did Batman, who doesn't have any fantastical powers. I'm not, you know, Chris Nolan did an amazing job of reinventing Batman. But you know how Kevin Feige has that that whole MCU universe? Sometimes it'll be politically serious. Sometimes it'll be mythic. Sometimes it's operatic. But there's an aura of welcoming entertainment that also comes with it. I swear to God, the guy who laid down that framework of something that actually does have some substance, if you want to think about it, but also is entertaining, is that Richard Donner Superman. It's a really good template. Because, you know, there's a lot of fun with the whole Clark Kent thing. And, you know, so that's why if you look at Kevin's universe, you can have Guardians of the Galaxy, where you're hearing like funk tracks in space.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And some of the movies I worked on, like Winter Soldier, you'll have like political undercurrents that if, you know, you can watch it and enjoy it, but if you want to stop and think about it, things like Civil War actually have mm-hmm. meaningful political undercurrent. Like, well, what do we do mm-hmm. if we have these incredibly powerful entities that are sort of like,
yes.
if they're a private enterprise and they're not answerable to either a governmental institution or an international institution, you know, we right. should think about that, you know, and
we've so, brought that up a lot before. Like, if you actually think about it, it's pretty realistic feeling.
Yes, exactly.
That movie in particular.
Right. You know, we're not in the world of just, you know, completely pantomime villains. That's a sort of bureaucratic and administrative and like political dilemma is what do you do with powerful entities that on the one hand can really help you, but if there's sufficient collateral damage for loads of innocent people to die, then, you know, who are you answerable to? And then you get into this real political thing, you know, with Captain America going, look, I don't think we should sign these accords because we're just going to have a bunch of bureaucrats and politicians potentially holding back, you know, necessary behavior. And then meanwhile, War Machine's like, yeah, but that's a really, I mean, that's pretty libertarian. That's a really arrogant argument because that suggests you're always going to make the right call.
Oh, right.
Captain America's like, well, you know, I'm not saying I'm perfect, I always made the right call, but I sure as hell know that a bunch of politicians aren't necessarily in a better position.
Oh,
you know, right. So it's a really tricky argument, which is the sort mm-hmm. of classic American voice of libertarian, you know, just leave me alone, minimum government interference versus a sort of European Union vibe of like, well, listen, we need some sort of accountability because otherwise we've got like rogue entities doing what they want.
I had right. absolutely no idea this is where we were going to go, but I am loving it. This is exactly my
story. Yeah, I don't know how we ended up here, but it was to do with the MCU. Now, my point just to...
Yes.
Just to finish up that idea, it's really just that, no, I didn't spend all my time as a kid, but yes, having been
oh, right.
introduced into the universe, thankfully by Kevin and the Russos and everything, I, you know, took it seriously enough to do research mm-hmm. like it might have been, you know, like a college project or whatever, because you have to understand the writers of these shows, you know, it's not just fluff and entertainment. Of course there's action sequences. Of course it's fun. Of course it's entertaining, but there's substance in there. And I've always mm-hmm. been fascinated without waffling on too much more. The other thing that I think is important to understand about superheroes is, I mean, it is in fact true that, you know, the USA has a very strong contingent of religious people to this day compared to maybe mm-hmm. Europe is maybe a bit more secular. But mm-hmm. you'd have to admit that in the year 2021, compared to like, I don't know, 1680, it's not like everyone is God-fearing. We live in a much more scientific age where not everyone believes that, you know, women were created from the rib of Adam and all the rest of it.
Right.
So in other words, there's a bit of a gap in the market for looking up to some type of entity that's sort of just beyond human, but not as abstract as something that's mm-hmm. unreachable. So that way, it's a bit like the Greek gods, like Zeus and
yes,
Poseidon. Yeah. And I think that's always held a fascination. One of the reasons it's so successful is there's something fascinating for human beings to contemplate characters that are sufficiently human that you can empathize with them because they argue mm-hmm. and they fight and they're not perfect, but sufficiently elevated to feel like it's not grounded in the routine of life and all the human characteristics you already know. It's something a little more elevated, something beyond
right.
the normal human experience. And I swear that's just a human, it's just one of those things human beings have always needed to look up to. And I think that's why yeah. there's this extra resonance.
I totally agree. I think it's, we need sort of these myths to connect to and to sort of to connect you personally, and I think to connect to others through. And I think that's part of what has made the MCU such a communal thing, more so than I think a lot of other franchises. I mean, a ton of franchises have big fan bases.
Of course.
But there's yeah. something where I think people really feel as though they're seeing themselves in these stories. They're getting a lot of this sort of particular, it is almost like a spiritual nourishment, not to put too much emphasis on the spiritual of it, but just, I think what you're saying is dead on. And it's a very different look at what a hero is too, I think, because I think if you look back at some of the superhero movies that started coming out there in the later 90s, or I guess really like early 2000s, there was a real emphasis, I thought, on kind of on trying to ground things in a very gritty way. Mm. And I think that sort of culminated with what Nolan did. And what he did yeah. really, really well.
Oh, yeah, he did it amazingly, yeah.
Right. But I think that we talk about Captain America being such an interesting thing. And I think it's funny that you tie it back to that Donner Superman film, because from the first movie, you know, that's penned by Marcus and McFeely and with Joe Johnston on it, it's like they really, like, if you think of Iron Man and of Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man as the heart of the MCU in terms of kind of injecting the humor and the quippiness, I think that's fair. But I think the longer you see it go, in some ways, I think the kind of very unironic, heart on your sleeve, just pure hero that Captain America was not really a character that I thought at the time would work
very well. That's a good point. Yeah.
You know,
that's a good point. You know, and some of
but
that
it's
was,
one that I think that DNA has kept on.
Yes. And I think when it's handled right, I think it cuts through, because you always need a bit of fluff and a bit of comedy so you don't take yourself too seriously. But there is something. Chris Evans nailed it. And if you get the stories right, there is ultimately an appeal where it's time for the quipping to stop. You know, one of the great things about having Iron Man around is he takes care of all that. And often the disagreements between Captain America and Robert Downey Jr. is he's being flippant. He's like, he's being self-centered. He's being narcissistic. And okay, he may be a bit squarer. He may be a bit straighter, but you know, he's, even though he doesn't necessarily have some of the powers the other characters have, notice how he's often the leader, because he is the one who can bring them into a team, stop people being selfish. You know, in all those Avengers films, half the time they're like falling apart and arguing and like getting things wrong. And he might not be as powerful and he might not have as much tech, but he's the first to realize when they're making the wrong decisions, you know, from like a spiritual point of view, and they're not working as a team. Or, and so, you know, he lightens up a bit. But I understand what you're saying. In like the first outing of Captain America, you'd probably think, look, if I wanted to go out to dinner, I'd probably have more fun if it was with Iron Man.
Right.
And we'd probably end up having a serious conversation about like how to bring up your kids responsibly.
Yeah.
With Captain America, it might not be quite such fun. But by the time you get through it, all the trials and tribulations that these characters have gone through, there is something enduring. And you know what? There are little clever, sneaky things in the script that, can you remember, was it the first Avengers or the second Avengers where one of the, you know, what's the name of the agent in Avengers who gets sadly killed?
Coulson.
Yeah. And he's like, listen, and he's really embarrassed because he's a bit of a fan. He's like, look, you know, I've been working on your suit. And he's and Chris Evans, Captain America, has the self-awareness to go, I don't know, you know, now it's not the 50s and, you know, he's out of the frozen ice. It's a little cheese ball to be wearing, you know, having a, you know, a Captain America suit. And that's when Coulson goes, well, you know, with everything going on, we might need a bit of traditional right now. You know what I mean? And it's little bits of script that cleverly suggest in the mind of an audience the thought you might be having, which is like, do we really need, you know, a sort of sentinel of liberty? And because by the time we get to the beginning of the 21st century, everything's more politically ambiguous. No one trusts their governments anymore. It's not like we live in a simple, well, some people do, but far fewer people just have confidence in, I will fly the American flag and I believe in da, 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 da.
Right.
And so to actually lay that doubt into some of the stories, like, for example, have Captain America even himself going, well, I don't know, I'm probably a bit of an anachronism, right? And then have one of the characters go, well, I don't know, you know, we might need some of that because everything's gone a bit crazy. You know, it's the equivalent of, you could say, why on earth does the United Kingdom have a monarch? I mean, it's ridiculous. One of the first smart things the Americans did, having got rid of British government and having celebrated their independence, you did all the smart things. Like, okay, let's steal all the common law and all the judicial, all the rest of it. But the one thing, you know, we don't need a bloody monarch. That's ridiculous. But the only reason the constitution and monarchs are of any use is like, you know, when times are crazy and governments come and go and you might get some crazy populist or a crazy bunch of socialists or whatever, it's quite nice to have sort of one figure that actually is sort of eternal and doesn't change. And you know, you can just feel like there's something. And I think Captain America's a bit like that in the MCU. There's a sort of there's something reliable in his set of, and what's interesting about Captain America is he keeps having to recontextualize his basic values and his moral compass. You know, he doesn't always get it right, you know, at the end of Civil War, it gets really tested. But
that makes me think of my question I wanted to ask you was, you talked about in doing your research on Captain America, going through some comics and whatnot. You were talking about how he changes over the decades, right? When you got Winter Soldier, I mean, it seemed like the Russos very obviously wanted to take Captain America, storytelling wise, to a new place too, right?
Oh, yeah,
they wanted to make him darker, edgier, start to question S.H.I.E.L.D., all these things we were talking about. Did they task you with doing that as well musically? And then my two-parter with that is, what is it like to work with somebody like take Alan Silvestri's score and have to like in some of those themes that he set in place?
Well, we did
also reinventing.
Yeah. Well, the funny, apart from one cue at the beginning, I mean, by the way, Alan Silvestri is like a personal hero of mine, but you've just made a really good point. The original Captain America First Avenger is very much in that spirit we were first discussing.
Classic
period piece, American exceptionalism. He's a sentinel of liberty. There's no irony.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The adversaries are self-evidently evil. There's no political ambiguity. And it's like a sort of Second World War period piece, right? So cut to
then he's got the black suit. He doesn't have the shield you recognize anymore in Winter Soldier. It's like right away, very different tonally in every way.
But look at the story. Instead of being set in 1950, whatever it was, or the late 40s, suddenly he's now a fish out of water in 2012 or whatever it's set. He's all over the place because it's like, wow, things have changed since I was last around. And straight away, the premise of Winter Soldier is that Fury, it's kind of the same philosophical beat as Minority Report in a way. What's basically happened is Fury's like, listen, we got to be careful, right? And my mission is to protect the American people. And I will stop at nothing to make sure that that happens. And if that means that we need to preemptively analyze with AI things that could threaten America. And if that means we have to set up a massive military industrial load of kit tied to policy, that means we take things out before they've even happened. Meanwhile, Captain America's like, wait a minute, I don't remember any of this. This is like some Orwellian, this is some massive, this is like government intervention that's reached like hideous report. And, you know, when Fury's busy showing off all the helicarriers, he's not buying it. He's like, I don't really like this. And can you remember, Fury goes, well, you know, you better get with the program.
Yes.
Because this is how things go down these days. And like, having come from where he's come from, he's like, I've only just like woken up and I'm trying to write down in my notebook, I got to watch Star Wars and various things. But meanwhile, this is not the America I remember. Like, don't you have to commit a crime before? And don't you have to have a trial? And, you know, like, what's all this? So the world he was in and the kind of action you get in it is so different that apart from one Alan cue right at the front, there's like a one cue that works from
right in the mall there at the beginning.
Right at the front. But apart from that, it was impossible to use any of the material for them because it just doesn't land, not because Alan isn't a genius. Alan's a total genius, but because the tone of the movie, the situation that he's in and the movie that the Russos were making was wildly different to the first one. So having put the flag in of that first cue in Winter Soldier that takes off from where Alan last left off, that's it. There's no more DNA from any of that. Everything after that is all new DNA. I did a Predator film where I did the exact opposite. Predator's one of my favorite scores ever. And Alan is in such high esteem that I deliberately wrote themes in this peculiar octatonic scale so that precisely I could still use the DNA from the original.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, when I really want to, I'm in a hurry to use things as and when. But in the case of Winter Soldier, after that cue, that was it. It was all new DNA.
I want to ask you a dumb question too. I've always wondered this, okay? I don't score films. When you get a project like that or Falcon and the Winter Soldier like you just had, do you get to write to anything visually, or are you just scoring it and then giving it to them and they're editing it with your score?
No,
do you see what I'm saying? Which one's first? No,
well, if you're lucky and you have a lot of time, you actually have this beautiful early period of creative space where you can write music like away from picture, which is a real luxury I always do when when I got the time and I really care about things, which is basically everything I do. you have a script, you have enough footage, and it's really useful just to write a standalone. For example, if you listen to the score, the soundtrack for Winter Soldier, the track called Winter Soldier on the soundtrack, and the track towards the end just called Captain America. Those mm-hmm. are like the original long form suites that I wrote away from Picture. Whereas some of the cues are heavily influenced by that and their rearrangements. But there were these original long, you know, almost like soundtrack ready, you know, versions that. So that I love having an initial period. Now, when it comes to the real detail, you know, once you get a really good cut of the movie, no, every single cue is specifically and, you know, meticulously written to Picture. Mm-hmm. But, and you know, which is one of the reasons I love movies. TV, there's very often not enough time. Not actually, the Falcon Winter Soldier show doesn't really count as regular TV because we had loads of time as a big artistic project. One of the great things about movies, is that thing where you have time, you know, because I would write those suites and I played those suites to the Russos before we even got into any discussion about any specific
game. Wow.
It was like, hey guys, I'm going to play you a Winter Soldier piece of music that is so radical that I think there's only going to be one or two reactions. You're right. You know, because I don't know if you know that track. You know the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
It's pretty badass. You know, there's a lot of weird noises at the front. It's all sound design. I basically, because I knew that they were brave, I took the attitude. I've written a lot of adversary themes for superhero. You know, even Magneto was pretty cool. But it was like, look, instead of just having a straight up orchestral theme, I might as well go down in flames if I'm going to go down. Why don't I? Because Winter Soldier is basically like a RoboCop thing. You've got someone who you love, like Bucky, but he's stuck and he's tormented and he's like robotized and stuck. So it's like a tortured human soul. I spent ages creating, you know, that noise that kind of goes like.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Specifically, what is that? What is that?
I'll get into that. I'll explain
that. My point is,
if you listen to that, you know, there's not a regular orchestral theme for about 4 minutes. There's more influence from dubstep and drum and bass and electric and all kinds of stuff before you get into the more orchestral stuff. So I thought, why not? I might as well start there. And if they go, hey, you know, we really love this, but maybe we could focus more on some of those more orchestral elements that come in the end. So anyway, I sit them down, turn it up really loud and go, listen, let's not worry about the movie. I've written a piece, right? And it's my vision of it. I think this is the sound of the Winter Soldier. Here we go. Hit space bar, turned it out really loud. And there was a bit of a deafening silence after. So I thought, oh God, I hate it. And Joe was like, I absolutely love it. And I was like, thank God for that. And he goes, and here's the thing. What I don't want is we hear this first piece. It's radical. It's Winter Soldier. It sounds like nothing I've ever heard. And then somehow when we get into the movie, it all gets like watered down.
Yeah, you start.
And then when we get, they say, I want to be like, whatever that crazy scream is, I want to hear that. Whatever that kind of mad horn thing is, I want to hear that. And he was so brave. He's like, okay, you know, the second half when it all kicks in with all the percussion and everything, just grab. Mm-hmm. And we were at the studio. I said, just grab that. And he picked a scene. He's like, just chuck it in over this scene. I was like, well, hang on, Joe. I think if that's going to be a bit much. I think for that scene, I'd maybe use, you know, like the front part where it's all like atmospheric. And he's like, no, I know what I'm doing. Just take the most radical bit of all and chuck it. That's just going to be like way too full on, you know. And so the music editor, and he just, in real time, he was just thinking of scenes going, pick it up. And from this bit here, try using that. And he's like, oh, I love it. Obviously, you know, you got to arrange it more to Picture.
Right.
Yeah.
So that worked out really well. Now, obviously, I don't think it's the very first thing we played Kevin. You know, it's just like, hey, Kevin. So, you know, this, you know, I mean, Kevin's open-minded, but I think we made sure Kevin heard a few, you know, Captain America heroic type cues. Otherwise, he'd be like, right, so what's happening? Captain America, was it turning into like a sort of mad underground electronic dubstep thing? But, you know, it works. People now, when you hear that. Right, so I'll let you know how that went down. What happened?
Please do.
What happened was I was obsessed by the idea. It's one of those things that only works with a hell of a lot of work. It's something you can think of conceptually, but until it sounds right, it's going to be terrible. So I said to myself, I don't want something super melodic. I want something so iconic that it really is just like one note bending into another note. Mm-hmm. It's when you hear me do it, like, you know, on Zoom. It's terrible, right? It's just this noise. But the idea was this noise needs to be the sound of, you can hear that it's human, right? It doesn't sound like a violin or any kind of instrument. You can hear that the origin of this sound is human. You know, it's like a wail. It's a kind of cry. But I'll have to fit and time stretch it and mess with it a lot with all the skills I learned in making, you know, drum and bass and all the rest of it so that it's mangled. You can hear. And I want to spend so long on this sound that in this one sound, it literally describes so much about what the wind. I mean, obviously there are notes and melodies and motifs, yeah, and everything, but just sure, in this one sound, I want the audience to feel terrified. It has to feel ghostly. It has to feel haunting. You have to know that it is humanoid in derivation, but like mechanized in its execution somehow. It's like, okay, well, that's a pretty tall order just for one kind of groan. So my very good composer friend, Dom Lewis, he's actually a very good singer. I said, Dom, it sounds a bit weird, but can you hang out with me for like 2 hours to do some singing? I said, now here's the thing though. It's not like singing, you know, I mean, he can sound like Justin Timberlake if he wanted to. And so he started doing it. And because he's a good singer, it sounded a bit like some R&B guy moving from one note. I said, no, Dom. It's like acting, right? Showed him stills, I showed him some footage. It's like, it's not really singing. It's way too technically good. I need you to like make a noise and I just need you to transition from one note to the next. It's got to be damaged. And for about 20 minutes, if you'd heard the recordings, it was laughable. Like, not because he's not, you know, we hadn't got right, to that place. And I could see people thinking, like, who was recording it? And like, we decided, you know, this is just comic.
You know, what are we doing?
Yeah. We've spent 25 minutes with Dom, who's a brilliant singer, groaning into a microphone and it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. As I swear to God, just stay with me. And suddenly Dom, to his enormous credit, not only was he a great singer, I managed to talk to him enough director-wise, you know, he was enough of an actor to suddenly fully understand he needed to be in pain and use his voice just to get, you know, I gave him the notes and everything, but he found this like acting place, as it were. And suddenly three popped out of him that were like, that's it. I swear to God, that's it. Now, at that point, it's a raw recording. It doesn't sound anything like what guys hear. And I spent a week, I time stretched it and fiddled with it and processed it. And then I sent it off to Al and Jack, the engineers, and they played with it and stretched it. And it kind of like a DNA had millions of versions of it. And I'm not kidding. Never has so much time and effort been spent.
Wow.
The man hours to finally pick out of 1,796 iterations of time stretched and generally mangled versions of it. We came up with the three that gave me the most kind of spine chills. And the thing about that sound is it's weird because it's not such a sound that it's only horror, you know, that you would use in like The Exorcist. It's got something slightly seductive and haunting about it that's a bit fascinating. Like when you hear it, you want to go, ooh, I want to see. You don't run. It's not a sound you run away from, like The Shining, you know. It says, it draws you in. You kind of go, you know, here it comes. And so I think it was really effective because it did so many, that one sound managed to manage, you know, imagine getting a speech from a producer where you would roll your eyeballs as an artist going, that's the most pretentious and impossible request. Like, okay, Henry, so I need a sound and it's got to be haunting, but not too scary. Okay. And it's got to be terrifying, but also it has to be alluring. Okay. But it has to be the bad guy, but not the bad guy, but it has to be. It's like, okay, this is ridiculous. Well, in one noise, I'm supposed to do that. But just thanks to Dom's amazing performance and the amount of, you know, mangling of it, we finally got there.
You did it, though. That's what I was going to say. We just did an episode on Monday last week where we ranked the best themes that's associated with a character in the MCU. And Winter Soldier came up because of what you just said.
Right,
it blows my mind that at this point now, anytime you see Bucky go into that mode, all you need to hear is either the or the and right away, like, we know exactly we know what you're talking about. So thank you for doing that. Like, we both wish the MCU did more of that. So I'm very appreciative of that. Now I'll let Robbie finally ask a question. That answer you just gave did not disappoint me. That was what I was wanting to hear.
No, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about as well. And I was going to say the same thing. I actually would say that of all of the themes associated with any character in the MCU, including the main heroes, I think that is maybe the most distinctive, just because it is, like, you're right. That's one that people automatically know, like, sort of on, in the same way. It's like, you know, you need to hear what, like 2 seconds to know that you're listening to Darth Vader's theme.
Yeah.
It's like a very similar kind of moment, which
and
is
I
super
And I had to do it without, no, I mean, obviously the Winter Soldier also has motifs and melodies, but the what made it an even more challenging mission is it wasn't using the architecture of melody or lyrics. It's not like, you know, obviously the Darth Vader thing goes bam, 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 ba, bam, bam, ba, bam. So you've got the architecture of a great theme, the rhythm, the melody, and all the rest of it. With the Winter Soldier thing, I had to pull off all the aesthetics, and it's really just, it's just one note going to another. But all this other narrative information has got to be delivered, not because it's a complicated melody that can deliver its intention, you know, using lyricism. It has to be delivered in some other way. and also because that's a more contemporary thing for this particular, you know, I love writing melodies, but for this particular mission, a traditional melody wasn't what I was after to get this particular idea across. So, you know, that's why, but I'm not pretending it all happened in like 5 minutes. Trust me, you know, it was the amount of man hours to get there was significant.
Well, and in general, I think that talking about Nolan's Dark Knight film, I'm a huge fan of what Hans Zimmer did with that score, especially because it's so unique in that you're just sort of, it puts you on edge almost the entire time. It's not super melodic the way even the first and third film scores in that trilogy are, because it's kind of mirroring that like chaotic, hectic energy from Heath Ledger's performance.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like what you did here did a really good job of keeping that. I mean, you have the breaks, and then I think the Cap theme so perfectly kind of is a foil to what you did for the Winter Soldier whenever you need it to be, but especially like the Causeway battle scene and what you're doing there, and just kind of the way that it raises the anxiety.
Exactly. No, Zimmer's a massive influence. If you think about, I think maybe even just me having the confidence to have the bravery of an idea that is not super melodic and is just an iconic noise is made possible by the sorts of things that Hans was doing, you know, way before me. You know, if Hans hadn't done, I mean, think about the Joker. One of his ideas for the Joker, which you need a similar, if not way more, confidence to do, is go, right, this is going to be a very cool 7-minute piece of music, and again, it's not going to be, I'm not going to achieve it with melody apart from the ostinato and the violin that goes cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. A lot of the Joker thing is the fact that in an unbearable fashion it goes now if you don't have the confidence to pull that up, it's like, well, I don't think we can sneak up, you know, and someone might go, well, yeah, maybe that rise could be, you know, for like 2 or 3 seconds. It's like, oh, no. This rise is like, it's going to be 2.5 minutes. and it's that sort of minimum. You need the confidence to do like a Philip Glass thing. I'm like, no. When I say that the bend is going to be the unbearable tension of the Joker, I'm doubling down. I mean that this bend is going to be the longest bend you've ever heard in your life. It's like, oh wow, okay, so you're serious, right? This thing's going to, and of course you put that in the movie and you're like, oh my God, I just feel like I'm going to explode. It's like, well, that's because someone's had the imagination and the confidence to double down on a conceptual idea that isn't necessarily made out of melody and the lyricism inherent in melody, but they've committed to that idea so heavily that it's devastatingly effective. But you know, you need some confidence to do that. And he was, you know, Dark Knight, when was that? 2008? No, it was eight. So the point being, you know, there are four, there wouldn't have been that sort of language in film score to open up the permission for me to have, to think that it's a, you know, it's an acceptable film music idea to have a long, elongated groan.
you know.
So, you know, I think if you'd done that in 1983, it'd be like, what the hell, what's this? There's some weird sound effect crept into the music. You know, it should be like an orchestra playing music. What the hell's going on? Fire him. The guy's an idiot.
Okay, I have one last nitty-gritty musical question then. One of my favorite melodies you've ever composed is the four chords you came up for Civil War with the... I basically just want to ask, take me through that one too, because somehow that melody comes across as like so much, so sad. And yet it's reflective.
Well, it can be like Marshall in those fight scenes too. Like it's so flexible.
Hang on. I'm going to see if I can migrate without the reception falling apart.
It's just, it has so much dimension to that. And then I can kind of bring this to current time by saying, I love that you worked that in multiple times in this most recent show.
It wasn't just a
Captain America versus Iron Man type sadness. It was also like you would just subtly hint it under Wyatt Russell saying one line that was kind of sad, right? Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, we're immediately brought back to that same feeling.
Yeah, let me.
Here we go.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to.
This is unbelievable.
Well, I have done so many things. Hey, by the way, we should talk about the Falcon. Just before I get, I know this is really annoying because you've just asked me a legit Civil War question, and while I've got it in my head, I'm gonna just do something else.
Oh yeah.
But you know, in the Winter Soldier, Falcon's important in Winter Soldier. But you know, in those action sequences, I never got more than about 7 or 8 seconds of like committed Falcon before. But it was enough for me to want to give him something. That, you know how Cap was in Winter Soldier, he was.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, God. Yes. Oh, my God.
That's incredible.
Et cetera. And so I wanted to give. So, but all I got to do for Falcon in Winter Soldier was.
He got this fanfare,
you know, and he had a lot of ostinato things. That were, but the main thing was laying down this, and for musicians out there, it's like a 3-4-1 singer. And the reason I did that, I thought, just in case, I love Falcon, and I didn't know what was going to happen with him.
Oh, interesting!
But
notice how the Cap thing is. It has a sobriety, right? A little bit of tragedy to it. The reason I gave him a 3-4-1 thing, Falcon's, because actually 3-4-1 in a, you know, I didn't go there, but the 3-4-1 sequence is the kind of thing where you could be going.
Yeah. Wow.
So 3-4-1 has an inherent blues.
Like a Louisiana feel.
Right. Now, of course, that's not, you're not going to hear it like that in Winter Soldier. You hear the version that goes. But inherently, it is, when I arrange the brass way, you just make sure it stays here, right? And so it has that slightly Aaron Copland feeling. But there's no denying that 3-4-1. Right. So then when it came to Falcon Winter Soldier, I said, oh, that hook that I gave Falcon, I always thought that was the beginning of something. But, you know, I was.
Oh, wow.
I had to finish the score. I couldn't get sidetracked and go, oh, you know, I should finish that. I feel like that's a superhero. So if you listen to the main on ends for Falcon, you know, the da-dum-dum, chicka-gung-gung, chicka-gung-gung, when, you know, first of all, it goes.
I have chills.
Right. So it does all that bluesy stuff, right? But then when the theme comes in on the brass, guess what? The first phrase. It's the same as Falcon, but then I got to develop it. Keep going.
Yes.
No, wrong chord. But you know, it's.
Yeah.
Except, you know, because it was the main on ends, I wanted to give it, you know, so it doesn't sound too classical. So you can feel the. Louise. Anyway, I just wanted to point that because it's a good example of instead of just starting from scratch, having the intellectual coherence to go, well, wait a minute, he didn't come out of nowhere. It's just you've got to keep writing.
So I feel like I know music pretty well, and I didn't even catch that. But now that you're saying it, I love it.
Well, you know, you probably got distracted by the chicka-gung-gung,
chicka-gung, wow, wow. And the B3, you know, the organ stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there's all that. You know.
Okay, but also show me Civil War now. I need to hear that melody.
The thing with Civil War, yeah, I think what the idea behind it was one of the quickest ways I thought, the general background to Civil War is it was a bit less techie, you know, than. Because it was a bit, by the time you get halfway through that movie, it's a bit more Clash of the Titans, a bit more mythic, gods versus gods. So I opened up the orchestral flaps a bit more and slightly, you know, pushed down slightly the more techie stuff. And the other secret I thought to Civil War was, and the guys did a great job, you know, the Russos in
it's one of our favorites.
Yeah, coordinating it. The trick is you've got a, it's a mini Avengers film. You know, you've got, well, I say mini. It, what I mean is there's a, it's a bigger ensemble. It's an Avengers film. It's an Avengers film that there are loads more people on screen. Now, intellectually, my pitch was the biggest way to ruin this movie and to do the opposite of what music should be doing is, it's a bit like mathematics. If you're any good at maths, your lines of working should be the least amount to get to the answer. You don't want, hey, look, I did like 16 pages of working to get to the answer. It's like, well, you're an idiot. You could have done it in five lines of working. What we don't want is every time you see a character on screen, you get the theme for that character. That's not film
school. Yeah, it's just
too
much.
Well, and also, you're not telling a story. That's not telling a story. The story of Civil War is of fracture and of the fact that there is a civil war between two groups. What we need, you still get quotes of, I had a Black Panther thing, I had a Spider-Man thing I was really gutted about that didn't, I was so happy with the Spider-Man thing. That could have blossomed into something.
I was going to ask you about that.
We'll get to that, we'll get to that. but the it's really important that one of the most important themes is in fact a Civil War theme itself, a theme which denotes discord, a theme which says that it's elevated and mythic, but has something a bit tragic and a bit fractured within it. And so the instead of being a theme applied to an individual person, the whole point about the Civil War theme, it's situational, you know. So so there's actually some inherent, I can't even remember the next bit. So I've been doing so many other bits of music. Let me see if I can.
That's all you need, though.
Yeah, but hold on. That's annoying that I can't remember it. Because it had this chord.
This is incredible.
I can't. Anyway, the point being that it's inherently somewhat formal. In that the chord sequence.
What is that?
Especially with the suspensions, you know, C minor going to a sus on the dominant, you know, meaning it's it's not quite. I mean, Beethoven would have gone.
But,
you know, you could imagine a. It has roots in, you know, it could be.
Wow.
It's something that, unlike a, like a 3-4-1 thing, inherent in this shape.
Yeah, but I love that you put the emphasis on that melody by making it more simple. So like when you build the, in the actual tracks of War, you have the bum 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 dun 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 dun.
Oh yeah, so that.
But then all the way to the bum 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 bum.
Yeah, yeah.
And emphasizing it instead of subdividing it.
Yeah. Even that ostinato is a little bit classical as well. I can't quite remember what it was.
Yeah,
and especially at the end when they're fighting. But you know, these kind of ostinatos are a little bit stolen from like Austro-Viennese, you know, like.
Right. But I just mean to put the emphasis on those notes when you finally get there by not subdividing. So just. Exactly. Man, I feel that.
Yeah.
Like when that hits me, I feel that down here.
Well, the other thing that's not, the thing that isn't classical in the harmony, if it was really strict classical chords, it would have gone.
And then, yes.
The fact that it goes, what makes it modern is having done the first one. That's actually harmonically a bit severed from the tonic root of C minor. So it's like, ooh. In other words, like the first sequence is in C minor, and then the chord after that is B flat minor, which is a bit incorrect, meaning the whole thing's collapsed downwards. So, I mean, that sounds a bit technical, but what it means, the feeling is a bit, it's a lot safer if you were to go.
Yeah.
If I was just to go, you kind of know where you are, but if it goes. It feels like the tragedy of the situation is like plunged down again.
I can't remember what I did after that.
Sorry, I've lost half our audience at this point, but I don't even care.
Now, I remember the fight at the end, I was getting really classic. There was lots of like...
Yeah.
You know, there's all that sort of ostinato was going on.
This is...
And that's, they love that. You know, at the end when it's just on the piano.
Yeah.
Well, Henry, we talk about actually, that's one of our favorite things about music and the themes is when they're versatile, when you can use them in the fight scene. But then, like what you're saying, you strip it down, you slow it down to just chill piano, and all of a sudden it's a totally different feeling. It's heartbreaking.
Well, that's,
and Alan actually does that amazing. The Avengers theme is the most pump up thing you've ever heard. Yeah. But then at the end of Infinity War, when he plays it just on a piano, it's like depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. Same, well, I mean, you know, Alan, the man can do anything. The that is one of the most fun things about, you know, how you go about. For example, yes, that. At the end of Winter Soldier was a really tragic thing. But, you know, there's other ways of playing it where it feels like, oh, yeah, time to suit up. Go get the shield. We're, you know.
Yeah. Literally time to suit up. Yeah, isn't that the track?
It just depends how you harmonize it. The other thing I really liked on Civil War was the whole kind of Zemo-y, thrillery, you know.
That was the other thing we had to ask about.
Those were the three things we were going to ask you, Henry. Winter Soldier theme, Civil War, and then we got to talk about the Zemo thing.
The Siberian Overture, I think.
It had this really spidery, for serious geeks out there, you know, like 20th century, the harmony is sort of interesting, right? And Alan's great at this. I mean, you know, you only got to listen to Predator. What I was proud of, you know how Zemo is very manipulative? And it's not that he's completely scary. It's this weird kind of manipulation. I was really proud of the scale I used because, you know, obviously your listeners probably know enough about, like, you know, if you have a major scale, you're not going to scare anyone because that's... Mm-hmm. You know, and even if you have a minor scale, i.e. you know, you can do sad sounding things with minor scale, but for Zemo, I use this other scale that goes... Which is a lot more like, ooh, hang on, I don't quite know where I am. So that's why the harmony in... You know, it's much more snaky.
Yeah.
And here's the really pretentious conceit, right? You know how Zemo was responsible for divide, you know, he was trying to divide the teams. So if you check out how the notes go... the Zemo theme, one note goes up, then one splits the other way, then one goes up a bit more, then the other one splits. If you drew it on a graph, it's like a splitting team.
Wow.
So now they're far apart. Then you start again on that note. It's the thing that starts on the same note, and every time it happens, it keeps fracturing, like a fractal it keeps getting torn away from itself.
That's incredible.
And you could keep going forever, you know.
When you wrote the...
Yeah.
What were you thinking of? Were you thinking of Zemo there too?
They're interlinked. This...
Sokovia?
No, not quite. They're interlinked. This thing is specifically Zemo, right?
Okay.
This thing here...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was a sort of, it pertains to Zemo, but it really played into the thriller stroke mystery of like, what the hell is going on? You know how in Civil War, there's an element a bit like Seven or something where it's like, what is going on with this guy? Like, you can't see how the jigsaw, it was like the thriller jigsaw that connects to Zemo, but lets the audience know. It's a sort of like, what's going on here?
Okay. You know? That's what I wanted to know.
Right.
It cuts to him in his hotel room, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, if it were one of those movies where there's a serial killer, it would be those scenes where it cuts to the serial killer, but you don't really know what he's doing. You don't really see him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then it fed into him a lot into the narrative. So yeah, it became another good secondary Zemo related motif.
That, well, because you bring that up in the show too.
Exactly. You know, at the memorial, it gets used.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I've been working on so many different things. I can't remember the notes.
That's okay. You know, we didn't expect you to perform the whole thing.
This is such a treat.
Oh no, words, wrong one. That's Jumanji.
Jumanji.
Yeah, but the I was so pleased about getting that out the gates.
It's funny. We have this playlist that we've made. It's just kind of our favorite moments going through all these scores in the MCU. And I was trying to pick stuff out of what you've done for Falcon and Winter Soldier. And it just wound up being a way larger selection than I'd intended. Cause normally I'm just trying to take a couple tracks from each score. But I just thought that you did such a beautiful and really interesting job of taking seeds from Winter Soldier and Civil War and using them in ways that I had never expected. I mean, Kyle and I were so excited to see that you were on the Falcon Winter Soldier project, because we always talk about one of the things that we sort of mourn sometimes, particularly in the early parts of the MCU, are that there was, you know, because composers would come in and different folks would take over. And sometimes, like, there were moments where you could have had not the exact same thing, obviously, but maybe something of a call out or a little homage. So we were so excited to see such a clear way to maintain that connective tissue between the Captain America franchise and this new stage. But I was so curious coming into this. Did you always know exactly sort of how much of that you wanted to pull over? I mean, we talked about the Civil War theme showing up, that Siberian Overture theme showing up.
I think reading the scripts, clearly everyone's in a different place. Bucky's a civilian. He has Winter Soldier, you know, outbursts, but, you know, his mm-hmm. journey is one of redemption and of making amends. And, you know, Sam's on a massive journey. Then we all, you know, and it ends up in, you know, as a whole new future for the franchise. So I think there were, even though situations are different, I think I knew even reading the scripts, it would be extraordinary if like no material could come across. But I think I might have been mm-hmm. pleasantly surprised as the actual episode started to come together. And as you started to like drill down into the narrative and go, oh, you know, this is cool. This could be a civilian Bucky, extraction from a Winter Soldier motif. This could be, oh, you know, the sort of
like that nightmarish track.
Yeah. And then the division between the team, you know, Walker and Battlestar, and the epic fight that's now starting to mm-hmm. happen has some of the mythic split tendencies of the end of Civil War. You know, maybe it's time to get, you know, that can come out. You know, I think as the show went on and having secured the new material, you know, for Flag Smashers and having got the Louisiana Hero and Sam, and the ultimate like new Captain America tune out the door. I think I was surprised it maybe ended up having more modulations of things like the Zemo theme, the Civil War theme, the Cyber, more than in a good way. I was pleasantly surprised for the same reason. It's much more intellectually satisfying. I mean, I keep coming around, you know, I was really happy that the actual main theme grew out of something else. So it feels like this enterprise that makes more sense as opposed to slapping new paint on things. There's something coherent. If you believe in the narrative and you believe in MCU and you believe that these characters have had a journey, then it follows that certain things aesthetically, musically, and thematically should come through. Because if they don't, then, you know, what the hell have you been doing over these movies? What's Winter Soldier and Civil War mean if none of these ideas can resonate as the show progresses? Of course it changes, and, you know, there's new ways to do things, new instrumentation, new ways to harmonize things. But if anything, I was pleasantly surprised it was more than I might have imagined, you know. So I thought that was great. And you're right. Yeah. I mean, you know, people sometimes like to know, oh, you know, why isn't there more of that? But, you know, you don't want one person doing all the music. You'd get bored. At least, you know, between Winter Soldier, Civil War, and this show, and perhaps moving into the future, this sort of particular set of characters have reached a point where I think, you know, even people who aren't like crazy fans of MCU like you guys, you know, I think they start to know what the Winter Soldier feels like in terms of sound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it starts to become, even if they can't articulate it like you guys can, I think audiences start to recognize that musical consistent narrative that accompanies the characters, not without even being conscious of it. You know, it just adds an extra layer of coherence to it, which I think, to your point, it is a good thing. And, you know, sometimes I guess it could have been exploited more. But you know what? It is what it is, because what you don't want a sort of monopoly where you have having so many different voices. The disadvantage of that is, okay, there could have been a bit more musical coherence. The downside the other way would have been a sort of autocracy where you're sick and tired of hearing the same stuff. You know, it's great that Guardians...
Well, it cheapens it.
Yeah, right. It's great that you think of, you know, if you think of the epic operatic fight at the end of Civil War and how wildly different to hearing like a funk track in space, Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. It's great to have different voices, different ideas, different minds, different
people
to be brought in. So there's probably a sweet spot in the middle, and maybe it's being found round about now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say what's so fun about your journey there, and I think you just kind of nailed it in terms of what the MCU has tried to do with taking these characters and kind of trying to stay true to the core of what they've initially introduced, but also showing some real growth and pushing them forward, even beyond maybe where comics fans would have expected.
Sure.
And I think that your history here in Marvel is kind of unique in that, you know, you came in at the phase two period and then the phase three period, and then Falcon Winter Soldier, and got to work largely with the same characters across those. And so I feel like your scores there are really a perfect reflection of what that looks like, of sort of being true to those themes and being true to kind of the tone and the feel while also allowing it to kind of grow and to go to unexpected places.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think one of the key successes to them, I mean, I don't know, think how many people have had the thought, wouldn't it be great to have a movie franchise that just churns out endless movies and could be amazing, you know, and hardly anyone succeeded. I think the reason Kevin succeeded is he's so passionate. He never thinks of any movie as churning out anything. He loves all of them. He's a fan. As well as being an amazing executive, he's never lost that basic fan type experience, which is
that's like, such a good point.
Right. Because, you know, once the billions of dollars start flying around, some lesser people become over influenced by like corporate responsibility and lose the you know, it's almost childlike. I don't mean childish like juvenile. I mean, it's untainted
like
by
wonder.
Cynicism. Yeah, exactly. He still, Kevin has that in spades and has natural instinctive reactions that are the same as an enthusiast, as well as all his, you know, executive skills. And one of those skills is that clever relationship between keeping enough of a consistency so that you don't go, what the hell is this? You know the feel of a Marvel film, but it can range. It can range far enough. You're like, oh, this is cool. They're going here. They're going there. This is fun. This is unexpected. This is controversial, or this is socially relevant, or whatever it is. There's enough invitation from directorial voices to bring new things in, to bring poses in. There's enough consistency with the left foot, and there's enough exploration with the right foot.
Yes,
otherwise,
it's a weird balance.
It's an amazing balance, because otherwise, you know, the reviews are going, oh, I see. So we're just knocking out another thing by the numbers.
That's right.
I feel I've seen. But then the other criticism is like, oh, this universe is a mess. You know, they jump from one movie to the next. I wouldn't even know it's related. The holy grail of establishing an overall set of atmospherics for a universe and yet having enough room for maneuver that you can get things as disparate as a raccoon having a fight in outer space, bantering, and then you could have a scene where Sam Wilson is being told by Isaiah Bradley that they'll never let a black man pick up the shield, and even if they did, no self-respecting black man should even pick up the shield. That sounds like surely that doesn't exist in the same year. One of them sounds like a, you know, like
sci-fi something.
Yeah, one is a sci-fi. One sounds like a socially important film that, you know, is a totally different kind of film that would probably gross less. It's like, no, here's the big surprise. All of those are under the Marvel. Those two scenes land with people, and people love and appreciate both of those kind of scenes, and they're all inside the Marvel umbrella. And, you know, I'm sure there are a few critics, but I would say in the main that people have reacted extremely favorably to the idea that Marvel, whilst staying entertaining, can Yes. Without being, you know, a polemic, heavy,
right,
you know, sledgehammer, without lecturing everyone, they've managed to incorporate topics that are, you know, socially relevant without patronizing people.
That's because even in the two examples you just gave, like in the Isaiah Bradley thing, in the show, they still find a way to work in some humor. Oh, and in Guardians of the Galaxy, they still find a way to work in the heart, like when his mother's dying. So like somehow it's still, I think you said it best, like to us, it always comes back to, this feels like Kevin's passion project.
Yeah.
It doesn't ever feel like he's doing it for money. No. Even if he is, because he's
making a ton of money. That's the secret. And that's why so many other people fail. Right. That's why so many other people fail, because the more money that starts rolling in, the more you would think the thing to think about is money. But it isn't, because the money is actually an energetic consequence of the artistic passion. That it's, and it's connecting with so many people.
Marvel's learned that if you let Kevin do his passion, the money will follow. Yes. Like WandaVision is the biggest swing ever. But at this point, you might as well let him try it. And then it ends up working amazingly well. Yeah. And the money's going to follow if he does what he cares about.
Imagine being in a meeting where Kevin, I mean, not that there's no one more important than him, but, you know, if Kevin went, hey, listen, I've got this crazy idea to do X. I mean, who amongst us would go, yeah, so that's not going to fly. That's a terrible idea. It'd be like, well, you know what? I think the track record of this guy is such that whilst I can't quite see it yet, let's just wait and see where this goes. And then sure enough, like, you know, 18 months later after development, whatever, 2 years, you go, oh, wow. Yeah, no, I totally see it. This is just pushing it in a new direction. But there's no sinners. Whilst, you know, the guy's got a sense of humor and can be self-effacing and is not, you know, he's perfectly capable of ironic self-reflection. There's a sort of fundamental sincerity. And I don't think you can succeed at the level he succeeded without. And I say Kevin, you know, there's Victorian, you know, there's more than one person.
Right, for sure.
But fundamentally, there's some, you know, energetic impulse that started this whole thing, and that has not become in any way jaded by the consequences of it. And, you know, long may that continue, because I think, you know, once that disappears, inevitably, you know, you don't quite know why you're, if the decisions aren't underpinned by the passion, then you have to start rooting for, you know, focus groups or statistics or you know.
Right.
And then, you know,
well,
you can still make a movie, but, you know, suddenly Rotten Tomatoes is probably going to be like 53% at that point.
Well, I have one more quick question about the past, and then one quick one about the future, and then we'll let you go, because I know we've already kept you a bit here.
This is way longer. Yeah, I love it.
I know that our listeners won't forgive us, though, if I don't follow up a bit on that Spider-Man theme that you were hinting at there from Civil War, because that's something that I've wondered about. I've had conversations about.
Yeah, because you had the introduction to Spider-Man and Black Panther, technically.
Yeah, I only had when he's swinging on the road, there's only a couple of really massive outbursts of it.
Right.
I put myself in it now, because hold on. No, that's King's. You know what? I'm totally screwing myself up.
No worries at all. And I wasn't even going to make you play it. I was just remember, curious.
It was just one of those mojo themes. We'll have to have, you know what, if we ever do this again,
please
remind me ahead of time, because your listeners are like, were irritated he couldn't remember his stupid Spider-Man thing.
No, and
I'll remember it. I suddenly now can't remember it.
That's okay.
Oh, no worries. But I would. That's a reason for us to speak again, because I'd love to. That is a conversation amongst to say nothing about what Michael Cicchino did, who he, you know, as always, has done a great job.
Oh, yeah.
But I know a lot of folks really love what you introduced there with the little bit of time that you got with Peter Parker. So I'd love to talk about that.
You can't have it all. You know what I mean? It's, right. You can't complain.
Right. So yeah, my final question there was, I was just going to ask what that you can tell us about. Can we look forward to coming from you here in the future, the immediate future, the distant future?
What can you tell us without getting killed? Sniped.
Yeah, without getting shot. All right. I can tell you that there's a really cool animated film that's not, you know, that I guess it was, it's
slightly in the realm of Big Hero 6 called Ron's Gone Wrong. That's great. That's coming out soon. But perhaps your fans might want. I think I would be allowed to say that my collaboration with the Russo brothers is to continue in the near future.
Okay.
Teaser, baby. Let's go. There's the tease.
I think if I said that, I'm not going to get into trouble. So I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Where can people connect with you? Are you on social media at all?
No, I'm the most absurdly old fashioned. Like, I just.
Then I love that. Yeah, I love that.
Yep.
I like Chris Nolan of you.
I respect that.
I hide,
that.
I write music. Well, look, here's the thing. I take the attitude. One of the things I love about film is, you know, I'm supposedly a, you know, half successful kind of an individual. But you know what's great about, you know, if you took some seriously famous like rap or hip hop and like R&B and pop artists and sent them all to Trader Joe's to come to get a loaf of bread, you wouldn't get in and out of there before all hell let loose. You know what I mean? They're so famous. They're so, and they connect with the public in a different way. And they're much more, you know, they're like celebrities and superstars. And it's actually specifically about them, you know. Mm-hmm. I reckon if you sent me, and I shouldn't give all these other big names because I consider them more senior and more important than me. But, you know, forget me. Supposing you sent Alan Silvestri, John Powell, Danny Elfman and Zimmer into like Whole Foods to go and get some, you know, they've all got to get a bag of peanuts. I think maybe, you know, Danny, you might start to get a few people go, oh, is that, I think that might be Danny Elfman, someone I think.
Yeah.
But if it were like me, Harry Gregson Williams, John Powell and Giacchino, I reckon we'd get all the way in, we'd all buy the peanuts, we'd all get to the checkout, we'd all buy it, and we'd all get out without being hassled, you know?
Sure.
And so...
As long as your music is not blaring from your headphones or something to give it
and
away.
And I love that because I'm a super private person. So it's sort of like the ultimate job because what happens is you're lucky enough that you work on these great projects that millions of people get to enjoy and they don't necessarily have to be obsessing about you. What they're really doing is they're enjoying the movie. And if you've done a great job, you've elevated the movie with the music you've written. What it isn't about is like daily updates about, you know, no one cares about, like, no one, you know, normal people, no offense to you, I'm not saying you're not normal. If you, if you do not have a specific interest in film music, there would not be a million reasons to know what I look like or even what my name is. And I love that about film music. So to be honest, I don't really see the need. I don't really think I'd change many lives by being on social media, whereas, you know, if Rihanna disappeared off social media, it'd be quite a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
The most important thing I do is do the music to the movies. As long as the music is in the movies and, you know, with
you're
more
good
specialist things like we're doing, you guys have, you know, it's like a more specialist interest in it. Any kind of more general public stuff, I honestly can't see the value in it for other people, let alone me.
Sure. Well, I love that. Thank you so much. You have no idea. This far exceeded our expectations for what we thought would happen, but we are huge fans and know that we will be tracking you, your career. We'll be the creepy people that are tracking you and following what you do. We are so appreciative of what you've added to these movies, but other movies as well. And it's been amazing that you could join us. So
cool. Well, we'll do it again, you know, when there's enough new stuff knocking about, you know, we'll do another one and do give me a heads up. Cause I feel like I've utterly disappointed both myself, my family, and everyone else.
Not at all.
Feeling to get that theme
your
out
country.
The door. Yeah, my country and my, you know, my new host country. But anyway,
I love it.
Very cool. We'll do it again sometime.
Perfect. Well, yeah, thank you again, Henry. Can't wait.
We'll make a tradition. Thanks.
All right. See you guys.
Wow. I mean, I'm not going to say this every time, but how cool was that access?
I mean,
if you're not watching the podcast, he took us into his like studio room and put the camera down by his piano for all of that. I mean, how cool is that?
Which by the way, we had not discussed at all. Like, not only did we not know that we were going to get over an hour speaking with Henry, we had no idea we were going to get taken into his piano room there and kind of into his musical mind. That was such a cool experience.
Dude, so unbelievably gracious of him to do that. Not only to come on the podcast, not only to give us over an hour of his time, but also to show us that stuff, like actually play it on piano. Well, I'm geeking out. As you heard in the episode, I literally geeked out.
Well, you know,
it's totally justified.
It's funny because we've talked about how much we would love to sit down with some of these folks. And I think for you and I, for the most part, that's been because we're such fans of just the work they've done. So we've, you know, we love to get to ask some of these more technical questions that you and I have kind of debated over in terms of how was the Winter Soldier sound created and things like that. What I did not expect out of an interview like this is to be speaking with such a legitimate MCU fan.
Right. He knew his stuff.
He knew it and he cares about it. And he, I mean, I feel like some of the story beats, some of the undercurrents that we've talked about really valuing even back to the original rewatch and the way that we structured that and the way that we were looking at character growth, like that stuff, I would have totally forgiven him if he's just like, you know what, I parachute in, I do what I need to do to write these good themes that fit with the films, and then I kind of step out. Like, I wouldn't hold that against him.
Right, like he's in a role where that clearly would have been accepted.
Of course.
You know, just get in, get out.
But that is just not his relationship to these films at all. At least from what I gathered from that conversation.
Oh, it was so much fun. But Robbie, that kind of puts a bow on Music Week for a little while. But do you know why that's important?
Why is that important?
Because next week starts Loki Week. I mean, we're basically here. It's absolutely insane.
Man.
So first of all, next week, Monday, is Memorial Day. So have a great cookout. See your family. It's going to be awesome. But then...
rest up.
Guys, we are starting a rewatch of Loki Central films really quickly.
Yep.
Like, we're giving you a heads up now because that gives you the weekend to watch some of these.
Mm-hmm.
But next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're going to have an episode out every day. So we are fully entrenching ourselves into Loki world because it's only like 10 days until we're actually going to see our first Loki episode. So that's unbelievable.
It is wild. Yeah, we're going to be posting a graphic on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, if you want to go look there. But just so you know, what we're seeing is the rewatch leading into this. It's kind of an interesting thing, and we'll talk more about this next week. Because in some ways, the Loki that we're meeting up with, that we saw use the Tesseract there in Endgame, has really only experienced the events of Thor and the events of the Avengers.
Right. Teaser, though. We'll get into that.
Right. We'll explore that more. But I say all that to say that if you're just listening and you're not a social media person, just to give you a bit of a heads up, what we're planning on doing is we're going to watch Thor, we're going to watch the Avengers, and then on Monday, Kyle and I will be back talking about those movies with kind of a fresh perspective as they relate to Loki specifically and kind of leading into that show. Then, for the remainder of the week, we're going to be revisiting some fun moments from Friends from Work past, going back through... our review of Thor the Dark World,
Tuesday,
of Thor Ragnarok,
Wednesday,
and a really fun look at Loki's role in Infinity War and Endgame. And that one is going to be especially fun, and I'll let Kyle tell you why that is.
Because on that Thursday episode, like Robbie said, we're going to talk about his adventures in Infinity War and Endgame, but also... give you another little clip of that conversation we had with Matthew Berry. Why is that important? Because Matthew Berry was literally on the set in the last scene we have of Loki before the show. Matthew Berry is the guy that is struggling over the Tesseract with him, and then he grabs it and disappears. And that's the last thing we've seen. So what a better place to get prepared for the Loki show than to listen to somebody who was on set for that scene.
Yeah.
So... next week's going to be a big week. I cannot wait to get ramped up for Loki. It's happening, guys. It's so much fun. So if you're just listening, like Robbie said, that's the details for next week. And if you're following us on social media at the FFW Podcast or the FFWpodcast.com, not only can you buy a shirt there, not only can you follow our previous rewatch, but we'll also be posting a graphic for this mini rewatch, that's Loki specific, on all socials. So that's where you can kind of follow it there, at the FFW Podcast. And as always, please feel free to message us on our website or on those socials, and we try to get back to you on there. For all of you that have donated, for all of you that have bought a shirt, we appreciate it so much. We couldn't do it without you guys. We can literally say that now. And so we appreciate your support, and we appreciate you listening all these years, and we cannot wait to show you where we're headed. So we'll see you next Monday on Friends from Work.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change, max 1 offer per account.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.